as proof that Islam by nature is peaceful and content to leave other religions alone. Juan Cole, a professor at the University of Michigan, even includes the verse in his list of the top 10 ways Islamic law forbids terrorism. According to Cole's analysis, Islam's holy book forbids coercing people into adopting any religion. They have to willingly choose it. That would seem to tie up the issue nicely and reduce concerns about Islamic treatment of non-believers to mere alarmism. But digging further into the Quran brings to light some contradictory messages. Let's go back to Cole, who also claims that verse 2:256 was never abrogated by any other verse of the Quran, meaning it would be established as the ironclad word of Allah on the topic. But Cole's case is not exactly ironclad itself. In fact, Stephen Coughlin, one of the top Defense Department experts on Islamic law until his politically motivated dismissal, uses verse 2:256 as a classic case study for the concept of abrogation. Coughlin points out that the pluralistic message of verse 2:256 is actually abrogated in the very next chapter, Surah 3, by the following verse. And whoever seeks a religion other than Islam, it will never be accepted of him, and in the hereafter he will be one of the losers. Quran 3:85. There may be no compulsion, but there is no acceptance either. Coughlin goes on to argue that the final abrogation of the seemingly benign verse 2:256 is found in Surah 5. O you who believe, take not the Jews and the Christians as awliya, friends, protectors, helpers, etc. They are but awliya to one another, and if any amongst you takes them as awliya, then surely he is one of them. Verily, Allah guides not those people who are the zalimun, polytheists and wrongdoers and unjust. Quran 5:51. According to Coughlin's analysis, Surah 2 is abrogated by Surah 3, and Surah 3 facilitates Surah 5. Because Surah 5 reflects a divine command from Allah, it becomes the end-state understanding of how an informed Muslim is to regard Christians and Jews. Other Quranic verses seem to contribute to the idea that Surah 2 is not the final word on the matter. In one particularly biting verse, those who suffer Allah's wrath, as unbelievers do, are referred to as apes and swine. Shall I inform you of something worse than that regarding the recompense from Allah? Those Jews who incurred the curse of Allah and His wrath, those of whom some He transformed into monkeys and swines, those who worshipped Taghut, false deities, such are worse in rank on the day of resurrection in the hellfire, and far more astray from the right path in the life of this world. Quran 5:60. The verse that precedes this one makes it clear that this warning is being addressed to the people of the scripture, or people of the book, a common Quranic expression for Jews and Christians. O people of the scripture, Jews and Christians, do you criticize us for no other reason than that we believe in Allah, and in the revelation which has been sent down to us, and in that which has been sent down before us, and that most of you are fasikun, rebellious and disobedient to Allah. In fact, this phrase surfaces in another passage that goes far beyond mere name-calling. Fight against those who, 1, believe not in Allah, 2, nor in the last day, 3, nor forbid that which has been forbidden by Allah and His Messenger, 4, and those who acknowledge not the religion of truth, i.e. Islam, among the people of the scripture, Jews and Christians, until they pay the jizya with willing submission and feel themselves subdued. Quran 9:29. Subdued. That is the proper state, according to the Quran, for anyone who does not believe in Allah. Over the course of history, the process of subduing unbelievers has taken a number of forms. Muslim armies of previous eras were not above slaughtering those they conquered who refused to submit to Islam. For example, Muhammad led his armies to slaughter hundreds of the males of the Jewish Banu Qurayza tribe in Medina. The men were beheaded, and the women and children were taken into slavery. When 20,000 soldiers of the Ottoman Empire, the last caliphate, captured the city of Otranto, Italy, after a two-week siege in 1480, they killed 813 of its citizens who remained true to their Christian faith. The martyrs of Otranto were among the first group of people to be canonized by Pope Francis in 2013. There was also the massacre and enslavement of millions of Hindus on the Indian subcontinent in the 11th and 12th centuries, the 1.5 million Christian Armenians killed in 1915, and the more recent beheadings of Christians by ISIS. Death was not always the only option, however. Once conquered by a Muslim force, non-Muslims could also become a zimmi, a protected person, who would still be allowed to live in the Muslim-run community. But zimmi can also mean guilty, and for the guilty there was a price for protection, often literally. Recall the Quran. Fight until they pay the jizya with willing submission and feel themselves subdued. According to Hugh Kennedy of the University of London, this passage explains that the people of the book, that is, Christians and Jews who have revealed scriptures, should be spared as long as they pay tribute and acknowledge their position as second-class citizens. This tribute is the jizya, a tax paid by zimmis that amounts essentially to blood money. Kennedy notes that zimmis were also often required to pay poll taxes and other levies. In addition, zimmis are known to have been subjected to other regulations such as restricted religious practices, required shows of deference to Muslims, and wearing distinctive clothing items. Some Muslim rulers actually preferred to maintain control over a large number of zimmis from whom they could extract jizya tribute, as opposed to forcing them to convert to Islam, which would eliminate their extra tax. The produce of the jizya, Kennedy notes, was very useful because it was paid in cash. This became especially valuable in the years when structure of caliphal finance collapsed. This should all sound somewhat familiar. The soldiers of the Islamic State, today's caliphate, have systematically executed Christians along with other Muslims, both inside and outside their conquered territory. In lawless Libya, for example, they have executed Christians and threatened the entire nation of the cross. In videos that went viral around the world, the narrator at one point says to Christians, "You pay tax with willing submission, feeling yourselves subdued." He quotes almost directly from verse 929. In Mosul, Iraq, the Christian community, which numbered in the tens of thousands, was given an ultimatum that would have made just as much sense to Christians facing Muslim conquest centuries ago. "We offer them three choices," ISIS said of Mosul's Christians. "Islam, the Zima contract, involving payment of jizya. If they refuse this, they will have nothing but the sword." Christians abandoned Mosul in droves. ISIS delivered an even worse fate to Iraq's Yazidi minority, a community with an ancient faith tradition that combines elements of Christianity, Shiism, and ancient religions. Tens of thousands were forced to flee their homes in the Sinjar area of northern Iraq as ISIS forces advanced. Many sought refuge in the mountains and endured a brutal state of siege. When the soldiers of the caliphate arrived, thousands of Yazidis were slaughtered, and several thousand women and girls were captured for ISIS to hold as modern-day sex slaves. A menu was circulated listing the prices of Yazidi and Christian girls. A female prisoner between 1 and 9 years old could be bought for $172. ISIS took pains to attempt to justify this practice by citing Sharia law. History is repeating itself. Once again, a caliphate is demanding blood money from non-believers. Those who don't pay up get the sword. But the justification for exacting payment of jizya has not changed. It's right there in the Quran. If that's your idea of tolerance for other faiths, then I'm afraid we have very different definitions of that word. Lie number 8. Addressing frustration, poverty, joblessness in the Muslim world, maybe even climate change, will end terrorism. Efforts to counter violent extremism will only succeed if citizens can address legitimate grievances through the democratic process and express themselves through strong civil societies. President Barack Obama. "We fight poverty because hope is an answer to terror." President George W. Bush. "We need in the medium and longer term to go after the root causes that lead people to join these groups, such as lack of opportunity for jobs." Marie Harf, State Department spokeswoman. Severe drought helped to create the instability in Nigeria that was exploited by the terrorist group Boko Haram. It's now believed that drought, crop failures, and high food prices helped fuel the early unrest in Syria, which descended into civil war in the heart of the Middle East. President Barack Obama. They are angry and perhaps justifiably so. This is a near-constant refrain we hear about the violent Islamist radicals who murder and brutalize innocent people, cut off journalists' heads, and dismember children. These poor, sensitive souls are frustrated by their lot in life. They are mired in poverty, suffering at the hands of powerful rulers. They are suffering from droughts and crop failures caused by the CO2 emissions from your SUV. They are suffering because of colonialism. They are suffering because of racism. They are suffering because of Islamophobia. The subtext is almost always that these terrorists are angry because of something America has done. Maybe their brother was killed in a drone attack. Maybe they heard about a Quran being burned or flushed down the toilet at Guantanamo. Maybe they saw images on Al Jazeera of Palestinian refugees suffering at the hands of Israel's bloodthirsty leaders. Images that were probably not even taken in Gaza, but are actually of violence in Syria at the hands of Bashar al-Assad. Or maybe they suffer because of the cruel, cynical bargains Western nations have made with Middle East dictators in a quest for oil. Whatever the reason, the thinking goes, these angry young men need our help and our understanding. Author Bill Siegel has written masterfully about this tendency to blame ourselves for terrorist actions. In his book, The Control Factor, Siegel suggests that when faced with a threat from radical Islam, whose singular goal is our destruction, we tend to frame our perceptions in order to give us the impression we are in control of something we are not, making ourselves the cause of the terrorist's violence because of oppressive colonial actions of the past, support for tyrannical powers in Muslim nations, occupation of Muslim lands, insulting of the Prophet, Israeli treatment of Palestinians, or occupation of disputed territories, failing to address Arab or Muslim poverty and lack of education, etc., as uncomfortable as that may make us feel, is still less threatening than the realization that we are absolutely not in control. It lets us believe that since we are to blame, we can fix it by changing ourselves. The truth is that we are not and cannot. Siegel explains that this compulsion to blame ourselves resembles the relationship between addicts and enablers. An addict typically blames his behavior on the enabler, who accepts responsibility and endlessly searches for ways to fix it. Unfortunately, this spawns a deadly cycle that grows more intense. While the enabler believes in good faith that they are helping to right a wrong, the transfer and acceptance of responsibility only invites more of the same behavior. Only when we are fully able to see the threat for what it truly is, Siegel suggests, will we be able to muster the appropriate will and clarity to transform our relationship and fight it. Put simply, they come after us because we are not them, not because of anything we do. As a result, terrorists continue to posture as victims, and we continue to fall for it. There is an endemic need within many free people, particularly on the left, to try to empathize with those who hate us, to understand our enemies so that we can bring them around, to use the Marxist lenses of class struggle and income inequality to examine problems that have nothing to do with economics whatsoever. They revel in psychobabble so that they might be able to do something to lessen the anger these poor and unfortunate terrorists must be feeling, and to assuage their own guilt for living a well-heeled life in a prosperous country. That, at any rate, is the approach that President Obama has repeatedly taken since he first held public office. As a state senator in Illinois, Obama proclaimed, "Most often, though, terrorism grows out of a climate of poverty and ignorance, helplessness and despair." Referencing terrorist Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, Obama cited the plight of Abdulmutallab's native country of Yemen. "We know Yemen is a country grappling with crushing poverty and deadly insurgencies. We cannot kill our way out of this war," said State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf. "We need in the medium and longer term to go after the root causes that lead people to join these groups, whether it is lack of opportunity for jobs. We can help them build their economy so they can have job opportunities for these people. Many others on the left have followed this same line of thinking. Touré Neblett, one of the co-hosts of MSNBC's The Cycle, once said that Muslim poverty is what threatens our security. Giving these men the chance to work here could diminish their poverty, their anger, and their misunderstanding of the U.S. before they are radicalized. It's easy to understand why some would prefer terrorists to be motivated by base emotions like anger. If someone is angry with you, you can talk to them, reason with them, address their grievances. It's the equivalent of the foolish U.S. legislator who once said during World War II, "Lord, if only I could have talked to Hitler, all of this might have been avoided." The problem with the idea that terrorists are attacking us because they are frustrated and angry about their status in life is that it just isn't true. Terrorists aren't attacking us because of our policies or past behavior or because we said something to offend them. They are attacking us because they are motivated by an ideology that urges them to kill in the name of God, that upholds martyrdom over life, that insists martyrdom will be rewarded with heavenly pleasures. Let's think for a moment about what the president is saying. Yes, the fact that you can't vote in a meaningful election in Syria is terrible. If you have a grievance about that, it's legitimate. But does that really have any impact on the thinking of lunatics who believe that murdering innocent people will get them a reward in heaven? Would Osama bin Laden have called off 9/11 if he'd been given a voter registration card? If poverty and anger at the establishment were the predominant motivation for terrorism, then there should be bombs and suicide attacks going on every day in parts of Washington, D.C., or Detroit, or South Central Los Angeles. Osama bin Laden, the author of one of the most effective acts of terrorism against the West in history, was a Saudi millionaire who, by some estimates, was worth $300 million. The Taliban, as rulers of Afghanistan, had it better than most of the people unfortunate enough to have been subjected to their brutal rule. That didn't stop them from supporting terrorism. Study after study has been done about those who join Islamic terrorist groups. In fact, one study by British researchers found that wealth and education were positive indicators for possible terrorist activities. Another survey of 400 Al-Qaeda terrorist biographies found that more than 60% of members had college degrees and that many came from middle or upper class backgrounds. A study of Palestinian suicide bombers found that none of the bombers were uneducated, desperately poor, simple-minded, or depressed. Many were middle class and, unless they were fugitives, held paying jobs. Two were the sons of millionaires. A 2004 Harvard study began with the reasonable assumption that terrorism has its roots in poverty. By the end, the study determined there was no significant relationship between economic conditions and terrorism. In the past, we heard people refer to the strong link between terrorism and poverty, said Alberto Abadi, associate professor of public policy at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. But in fact, when you look at the data, it's not there. This is true not only for events of international terrorism, as previous studies have shown, but perhaps more surprisingly also for the overall level of terrorism, both of domestic and of foreign origin. Islam expressly forbids anger as a justification for jihad. Consider the words of James Cromedy, a New Jersey native who converted to Islam in prison and gave himself the name Abdul Rahman. In 2009, Cromedy was arrested by the FBI after attempting to organize a terror plot to blow up two New York synagogues and launch Stinger anti-aircraft missiles at a National Guard base. During his long conversations with an FBI confidential informant, CI, Cromedy discussed a confrontation he'd had with a Jewish man at his hotel. Cromedy, "But sometime I just want to grab him and, just kill him. But I'm Muslim, insha'Allah, Allah will take care of it." CI, "Insha'Allah, if you, brother, if you really have to do something, you have to do something in jihad and try to do something." Cromedy, "No, because you angry, CI, angry." Cromedy, "No, you have to do it where it's fisabilillah." Fisabilillah, the phrase means literally, "in the cause of Allah." And according to the Quran, it's the only legitimate reason for a Muslim to engage in jihad. Cromedy is not alone when he rejects a worldly motivation such as anger as a reason for killing. One of al-Qaeda's earliest members, Sayyid Imam al-Sharif, also known as Dr. Fadl, wrote Jihad and the Effects of Intention Upon It, in which he cited Quranic verses and authentic hadiths in order to affirm that the desire for wealth, fame, glory, or petty emotions was not sufficient for a jihadist to obtain a heavenly reward. Among the reported quotes of Muhammad and hadith that Fadl cites is this one. Whoever is killed beneath a blind banner, becoming angry for the group and fighting for the group, then he is not from my ummah. Despite the claims to the contrary by a sympathetic media, anger over colonialism or wounds from foreign domination isn't the reason for jihadist violence. It's just an excuse. Instead, firmly based in Islamic theology, Fadl urged would-be terrorists. So strive for righteous intentions so that you will benefit from your actions and your jihad, as the Sharia has made the rewards of jihad contingent upon the correct intentions of the one performing. In other words, terrorists lining up to don suicide vests because they're angry or because they just got a pink slip at work are actually giving up their ticket to paradise. Given this clear line, why are our Western leaders indulging in the dangerous fantasy that alleviating the anger and hopelessness that exists in the Muslim world would make everything fine? Because believing we are responsible for terrorism assuages the modern West's profound sense of guilt and self-doubt. They want to believe that there is a way to end terrorism without violence, that if we just throw enough money at the problem, it will eventually go away. Of course, that will not work. Terrorist grievances have less to do with personal anger and disaffection and more to do with the religious ideology they've sworn their lives to. This necessitates a fundamentally different approach. They cannot be appeased. They cannot be reasoned with. They cannot be bribed with better jobs or cars or democratic rights. They can only be defeated. Lie number 9. Critics of Islam are bigots. I consider it part of my responsibility as President of the United States to fight against negative stereotypes of Islam wherever they appear. President Barack Obama. Islamophobia is a growing phenomenon in our society that needs to be challenged through proactive efforts. Everyone needs to do their part. CARE National Executive Director Nihad Awad. On the afternoon of April 26, 2014, Paul Weston, a British candidate for election to the European Parliament, was arrested as he gave a speech in the city of Winchester. In the course of his remarks, Weston mentioned the curses of Islam, which he called dreadful for his devotees. He had deplored the idea that every woman must belong to some man as his absolute property, and argued that Islam paralyzes the social development of those who follow it. He concluded by calling Islam a militant and proselytizing faith. Weston was placed under arrest for suspicion of religious racial harassment and was jailed for several hours before being released. Many people quickly condemned Weston as an Islamophobe for his speech. It's a trendy new phrase unleashed by apologists to scare people away from criticizing Islam. But here's the most interesting part of the story. The words Paul Weston spoke that day, and for which he was arrested, were not his own. They were originally written by a man to whom modern Britain owes nothing less than its very existence, Sir Winston Churchill. Churchill had penned the lines decades earlier in a book titled The River War, an account of the reconquest of Sudan. In provident habits, slovenly systems of agriculture, sluggish methods of commerce, and insecurity of property exist wherever the followers of the Prophet rule or live. Thousands become the brave and loyal soldiers of the faith. All know how to die, but the influence of the religion paralyzes the social development of those who follow it. No stronger retrograde force exists in the world. Far from being moribund, Mohammedanism is a militant and proselytizing faith. In present-day Great Britain, Winston Churchill, savior of Europe, defender of the West, champion of democratic values, and close ally of Franklin Roosevelt, would likely be behind bars, branded as a notorious Islamophobe who dared to offer criticism about Islam and its teaching. Islam apologists go to great lengths to prove that people are perfectly free to question Islam, so long as they stay within carefully prescribed limits. For example, the Council on American Islamic Relations, CAIR, claims, "We do not label all or even the majority of those who question Islam and Muslims as Islamophobes. Equally, we believe it is not Islamophobic to denounce crimes committed by individual Muslims or those claiming Islam as a motivation for their actions." Yet that is exactly what they do. CAIR and its secular leftist allies, like the ironically named group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, delight in levying the charge of Islamophobia at people who do simply question Islam and Muslims. In fact, FAIR has a Nixonian hit list of their supposed enemies, which they label as some of the media's leading teachers of anti-Muslim bigotry, serving various roles in the Islamophobic movement. These nefarious ne'er-do-wells, the group goes on to claim in paranoid fashion, form a network that teaches Americans to see Islam in fearful terms and their Muslim neighbors as suspects. Among those targeted, Bill O'Reilly, the writer Mark Stein, Daniel Pipes, and Sean Hannity. And of course, me. The George Soros-funded group Media Matters has its own version of a hate list which, curiously, includes only conservatives as anti-Islam bigots. Brian Kilmeade, Roger Ailes, Newt Gingrich, Reverend Franklin Graham, and Greg Gutfeld. And of course, me again. The origins of the term Islamophobia have unsurprisingly been traced back to the United Kingdom. In a 1997 report from the Runnymede Trust, which bills itself as the UK's leading independent race equality think tank, the group described Islamophobia as unfounded hostility towards Islam and therefore fear or dislike of all or most Muslims. That's actually not a bad definition. Unfounded hostility toward Islam and dislike of all or most Muslims may very well be Islamophobic. But that definition certainly doesn't apply to me, and I'll bet that it doesn't apply to any of the other people on the FAIR and Media Matters hit lists either. Besides, that is not how Islamophobia has been defined by groups like CAIR, which, it should be noted, has a checkered history of radical connections, including links to Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood, and was an unindicted co-conspirator in the U.S. government's case against the Holy Land Foundation, which gave money to Hamas. This is how CAIR defines the concept. Islamophobia is closed-minded prejudice against or hatred of Islam and Muslims. An Islamophobe is an individual who holds a closed-minded view of Islam and promotes prejudice against or hatred of Muslims. The convenient part for them is that the definition of closed-minded and prejudice is whatever they want it to be. It's pretty clear that CAIR's definition of Islamophobia includes anyone who's ever said anything even slightly negative about Islam or who's challenged others to think critically about the connection between Islam and Islamic terrorism. As it happens, that's a long list of people, including some of the most distinguished minds in the Western world, from Tocqueville to Patton to former American presidents. In 1843, for example, the acclaimed author Alexis de Tocqueville wrote that he had studied the Quran a great deal. His conclusion was that there have been few religions in the world as deadly to men as that of Muhammad. John Quincy Adams, the former president of the United States and a champion for the rights of freed slaves, also reportedly blasted Islam in remarks that would lead him to be condemned and jailed today. He, Muhammad, declared undistinguishing and exterminating war as a part of his religion against all the rest of mankind, Adams noted. The precept of the Quran is perpetual war against all who deny that Muhammad is the prophet of God. General George Patton, one of the liberators of Europe, also had unflattering things to say about Islam. "To me," Patton said, "it seems certain that the fatalistic teachings of Muhammad and the utter degradation of women is the outstanding cause for the arrested development of the Arab. He is exactly as he was around the year 700, while we have kept on developing." Liberal Bill Maher has noted that there's only one faith that kills you or wants to kill you if you draw a bad cartoon of the prophet, and that there's only one faith that kills you or wants to kill you if you renounce the faith. He added this is not just a small group of zealots. It's more than just a fringe element. He went on to say that comparison of Muslim violence to Christianity was liberal bullshit. There are plenty of serious people who've made smart observations about Islam over the years. Throwing around the charge of Islamophobia has become a knee-jerk reaction, a cudgel for clobbering anyone who dares to seek or speak the truth. Its purpose, and the agenda of groups that use the term, is the distinctly illiberal goal of stifling different points of view. Islam makes very large claims for itself, the late Christopher Hitchens, an acclaimed writer who was the toast of leftist elites, once wrote. In its art, there is a prejudice against representing the human form at all. The prohibition on picturing the prophet, who was only another male mammal, is apparently absolute. So is the prohibition on pork or alcohol or, in some Muslim societies, music or dancing. Very well, then. Let a good Muslim abstain rigorously from all these, but if he claims the right to make me abstain as well, he offers the clearest possible warning and proof of an aggressive intent. That's not bigotry or intolerance or irrational fear of someone different. That is just someone speaking the truth. Those who tend to hurl allegations of hate, intolerance, and bigotry at those of us who have the temerity to question and challenge some of the teachings and traditions of Islam are in fact projecting the reality of their own hate, intolerance, and bigotry on the rest of us. We cannot let accusations from others distract us. You know what's in your heart, and I know what's in mine. Question with boldness, speak the truth, and the rest will take care of itself. Lie number 10. Islam respects the rights of women. While it needs to be acknowledged that atrocities have been committed against women overseas in the name of Islam, it also needs to be acknowledged that such practices have no basis in the religion itself. More than 1,400 years ago, Islam afforded women rights comparable to those in our contemporary international human rights documents. Gaina Krayem and Haysom Farachi, op-ed, Sydney Morning Herald. Contrary to how popular culture portrays Muslim women's rights and privileges, Islam gives women many rights, including the right to inherit, to work outside the home, and to be educated. As in all cultures and communities, these rights are often violated. This is the result of the intersection of Islam with existing cultural norms, which may reflect male-dominated societies. In Muslim communities, women often have a strong influence in the family, the workplace, the religion, and society in general. Beliefs and Daily Lives of Muslims, PBS Frontline. Violent acts of terrorism in the name of Islam are all too common. Less visible, but no less shocking, are the individual acts of cruelty perpetrated against women in the name of radical Islam. While some would undoubtedly prefer to ignore this fact, those who commit these attacks can easily find justification for them under Islamic law. Islam has apologists both inside and outside the faith who argue that there is nothing in the teachings of the religion that could lead to repression or violence against women. To them, it's always something else, some sinister outside force that creates a situation for which Islam is unjustly blamed. Two Australian Muslims, an imam and a scholar in Islamic family law, co-wrote a disturbing op-ed defending Sharia that was published in the Sydney Morning Herald in 2008. In it, they claimed that Islam pioneered the field of women's rights centuries ago, and that atrocities committed against women overseas in the name of Islam, which they at least acknowledge have occurred, have no basis in the religion itself. Instead, they blame other factors, notably cultural practices alien to the religion itself. The television program Frontline, which airs on the U.S. government-subsidized public broadcasting service, takes the blame game a level further. According to its Teacher's Guide on the Beliefs and Daily Lives of Muslims, the violation of the rights of women in Muslim communities is the result of the intersection of Islam with existing cultural norms, which may reflect male-dominated societies. Islam itself, they seem to suggest, is a feminist paradise upset only by a violent patriarchy that is separate and apart from the religion itself. In fact, the Quran does seem to back up the idea that women, at least Muslim women, are on equal footing with men, at least when it comes to rewarding their faith. So their Lord accepted of them their supplication and answered them. Never will I allow to be lost the work of any of you, be he male or female. You are members one of another. Quran 3:195. Whoever works righteousness, whether male or female, while he or she is a true believer of Islamic monotheism, verily to him, we will give a good life in this world with respect, contentment, and lawful provision, and we shall pay them certainly a reward in proportion to the best of what they used to do, i.e. paradise in the hereafter. Quran 16:97. These verses pertain to the rewards women will receive in the afterlife, which may well be equal to those of men, but on earth, the reality for women under Islamic rule is very different. A look at the Quran and other Islamic teachings shows that denigration of women, and even violence against them, are hardly alien to the religion. A number of Quranic verses establish a clear-cut difference in the rights of men and women in various aspects of daily life, and the men always seem to get the advantage. A man can marry multiple women as long as he feels he can manage it, and if you fear that you shall not be able to deal justly with the orphan girls, then marry other women of your choice, 2 or 3 or 4, but if you fear that you shall not be able to deal justly with them, then only one, or the captives and the slaves, that your right hands possess. That is nearer to prevent you from doing injustice. Quran 4:3. Women automatically receive less in inheritance. Allah commands you as regards your children's inheritance. To the male, a portion equal to that of 2 females. If there are only daughters, 2 or more, their share is 2/3 of the inheritance. If only 1, her share is half. Quran 4:11. In a trial, 1 male witness is worth 2 females. Get 2 witnesses out of your own men, and if there are not 2 men available, then a man and 2 women, such as you agree for witnesses, so that if one of them, 2 women, errs, the other can remind her. Quran 2:282. In divorce cases, men automatically have a higher degree of rights. Divorced women shall wait, as regards their marriage, for 3 menstrual periods, and it is not lawful for them to conceal what Allah has created in their wombs, if they believe in Allah and the Last Day. And their husbands have the better right to take them back in that period, if they wish for reconciliation. And they, women, have rights over their husbands as regards living expenses, etc., similar to those of their husbands over them as regards obedience and respect, etc., to what is reasonable, but men have a degree of responsibility over them. Quran 2:228. Appearing on NBC's Today Show in 2007, Masumeh Ebtekar, the first woman to serve as a cabinet secretary in Iran, claimed that things were looking up for women in her country. "It takes time to change the laws in favor of women," she said, "but we have had lots of improvements." I suppose it's not hard to improve when you're starting from such a barbaric place. Here are just a few things a woman in Iran was still banned from doing under Islamic law back when Ebtekar appeared in 2007. Expose her head. Apply for a passport without her husband's permission. Sing any way she chooses. Divorce her husband without cause. Husbands can divorce for any reason. Commit adultery and live. Inherit an equal share as her brother. Watch men play sports, with a few exceptions. Marry a non-Islamic man. Be in a relationship with another woman. Publicly socialize with men. Sit in the front of a bus. Run for president. Travel, work, or go to school without her husband's permission. Attend her father's funeral without her husband's permission. Express opposition to the government. Countless numbers have been tortured for doing so. Have unsanctioned interviews with foreign media. Maintain custody of her children should her husband decide to have another wife. Object to having acid thrown in her face. Choose not to have children. Law pending. Have sex outside of marriage. Get a degree in engineering, physics, computer science, English literature, or business. But at least she can drive, unlike women in other Islamic countries like, say, Saudi Arabia. Yet none of this has stopped the empty-headed fools at Vogue magazine from dubbing Tehran, yes, Tehran, the next Aspen. They apparently didn't realize that under Iran's Islamic law, women are not even allowed to ski unaccompanied on slopes. Perhaps the one verse in the Quran that gives men the greatest blanket dominion over women also serves as a detailed guide on how to inflict punishment. Men are the protectors and maintainers of women because Allah has made one of them to excel the other, and because they spend to support them from their means. Therefore, the righteous women are devoutly obedient to Allah and to their husbands, and guard in the husband's absence what Allah orders them to guard, e.g. their chastity, their husband's property, etc. As to those women on whose part you see ill conduct, admonish them first. Next, refuse to share their beds. And last, beat them, lightly if it is useful, but if they return to obedience, seek not against them means of annoyance. Surely Allah is ever most high, most great. Quran 4:34. Muslim women who may be perceived by their husbands as behaving with ill conduct should be admonished, then denied marital relations, and then beaten. Thankfully, they can be forgiven, as long as they obey, of course. Another verse from the Quran gives Allah's permission to keep women as captive slaves for sexual relationships outside marriage. Also forbidden are women already married, except those captives and slaves whom your right hands possess. Thus has Allah ordained for you. Quran 4:24. In the Islamic tradition, those whom your right hands possess is a euphemism for slaves who were allowed to be kept as spoils of war. While the Quranic justification for treating women in unfair and violent ways is clear, one would hope those views would have evolved in the intervening centuries. In 1997, Yusuf al-Qaradawi, an influential cleric, told his television audience, "Beating is permitted to the man in the most limited of cases, and only in a case when the wife rebels against her husband. The beating, of course, will not be with a whip, a stick, or a board." This is especially disturbing considering the widespread view in the Muslim world that wives must be subservient to their husbands. This was confirmed by a 2013 Pew Research Center survey which asked Muslims, both men and women, "Must a wife always obey her husband?" In 20 of 23 countries surveyed, at least half responded yes. Islam's retrograde views toward women aren't just confined to the realm of the theoretical. In Pakistan, a woman can prove rape only if 4 adult males of impeccable character witness the actual penetration. An Islamic marriage guide called A Gift for Muslim Couples advises husbands on the best ways to beat their wives. It turns out that it's most effectively done with a hand or stick or pull her by the ears. And female genital mutilation, one of the most barbaric practices conceived by the human mind, is practiced in some parts of the Islamic world as a way of supposedly controlling the sexual urges of women. We see in the Islamic State how radical Islamists use the Quran to justify unspeakable horrors that in a sane world would earn blanket condemnation from self-proclaimed feminists like Lena Dunham, Susan Sarandon, Jane Fonda, Sandra Fluke, and the pretentious, pantsuited phonies of the National Organization of Women, NOW. As the Islamic State's caliphate expands across Iraq and Syria, stories of women living under Sharia law are becoming even more harrowing. One ISIS savage by the name of Abu Anas Alibi has reportedly killed more than 150 women and girls for refusing to become jihad brides, temporary sex slaves for ISIS fighters. They include girls 14, 15, and younger. Women captured by the Islamic State are so traumatized by the rape and torture that they are strangling each other to commit assisted suicide. ISIS has ordered all girls and women in Mosul, Iraq, between the ages of 11 and 46, to undergo female genital mutilation. Worse is the fate that awaits non-Muslim women, such as the Yazidi minorities of northern Iraq. The surviving victims have given lurid, medieval descriptions of the caliphate's slave markets. "They put us up for sale. Many groups of fighters came to buy. Sometimes they brought girls back who had been beaten, injured. When they recovered, they were sold again. Eventually, they took all the girls." ISIS's research and fatwa department did, of course, make sure to issue a pamphlet carefully outlining rules for the treatment of slaves, including sexual relations with those who have not yet reached puberty. It was blandly titled Questions and Answers on Taking Captives and Slaves and came complete with Quranic citations. Given what we have seen, this shouldn't surprise anybody. If people are only willing to open their eyes and look to the sources of Islamic thought, they will see that subjugation of women falls right in line with the vision for a modern caliphate. Lie number 11. Iran can be trusted with a nuclear weapon. Nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction have no place in Iran's security and defense doctrine and contradict our fundamental religious and ethical convictions. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. We are in fact closer than ever to the good, comprehensive deal that we have been seeking, and if we can get there, the entire world will be safer. Secretary of State John Kerry. Barack Obama seemingly has an obsession with making a nuclear deal with the leaders of Iran. Back in 2007, he talked eagerly about engaging in aggressive personal diplomacy with the clerics in Tehran. Even Hillary Clinton mocked Obama at the time as naive on foreign policy. If only we'd talk to our enemies. It's a refrain we've heard many times in history, often from people who wrongly assume that every leader is rational and receptive to diplomacy. In fact, that was the stance of many on the left for most of the Cold War as they rallied against Ronald Reagan, the warmonger, who led a military buildup to confront the Soviet Union. Time and again, we heard them argue for peaceful coexistence with the Soviets. Negotiation, discussion. When Reagan and Margaret Thatcher and Pope John Paul II and Lech Wałęsa and others stood up to the threat and then toppled Soviet governments, the lies those leftists had told were exposed. In fact, we learned it was true that many Soviets wanted to invade or destroy the United States. They had plans for conquering Western Europe and then America and believed that communism was the future for mankind. The left was wrong during the Cold War, and they are even more wrong today about Iran. After his re-election in 2012, Obama doubled down on his pursuit of Iran, calling for a more serious, substantive discussion about their nuclear ambitions. 3 years later, after negotiating a deal that would allow Iran to develop nuclear capability for peaceful purposes, Secretary of State John Kerry gloated, "This is an agreement that is based on transparency, accountability, verification." Echoing Kerry, President Obama has repeatedly claimed that Iran has no aspirations for a nuclear weapon, citing an alleged fatwa from Iranian Supreme Ruler Ayatollah Ali Khamenei that possessing such a weapon was anti-Islamic. Obama has celebrated, in his words, "a deal that allows them to have peaceful nuclear power but gives us the absolute assurance that is verifiable that they are not pursuing a nuclear weapon." The president added that, "If in fact what they claim is true, which is they have no aspiration to get a nuclear weapon, that in fact according to their supreme leader, it would be contrary to their faith to obtain a nuclear weapon. If that is true, there should be the possibility of getting a deal." Okay, fair enough. But that is not true. As a recent article in U.S. News and World Report concluded, there is no evidence of any fatwa of this sort from Khamenei. And even if there were, why on earth would we believe him? James S. Robbins, a senior fellow in national security affairs at the American Foreign Policy Council, did some additional research on this supposed fatwa, writing, "The nearest thing to an official text can be found on the webpage of Iran's permanent mission to the United Nations. This version, dated February 19, 2012, declares that the Iranian nation has never pursued and will never pursue nuclear weapons. There is no doubt that the decision makers in the countries opposing us know well that Iran is not after nuclear weapons because the Islamic Republic, logically, religiously, and theoretically, considers the possession of nuclear weapons a grave sin and believes the proliferation of such weapons is senseless, destructive, and dangerous. That's all well and good, but it is not exactly a fatwa. It makes no reference to the Quran or any other Islamic text or tradition, as other religious edicts traditionally do. It reads more like a statement of government policy, and as such, can be changed with the circumstances. In fact, even genuine fatwas can be amended and changed by circumstances." In 2012, Alireza Forkhani, a former Iranian governor and advisor to Ayatollah Khamenei, wrote an article widely publicized in Iran arguing that, in fact, Muslims must have access to nuclear weapons. The Islamic world should rise up and shout that a nuclear bomb is our right, Forkhani wrote, and disrupt the dreams of America and Israel. Here's the truth, and it's pretty simple. The radicals in charge of Iran seek our destruction. They want to kill us. But don't just take my word for it. They say it themselves. There's a mural on display in the Iranian capital of Tehran, a mural that would not be permitted unless it reflected the views of the Iranian government, that has the phrase, "Down with the USA," printed on it in English. That's bad enough, but far worse is the actual translation in Persian written at the bottom of the mural. "Death to the USA." "Death to America" is a chant that Iranians utter all the time, during political rallies and even during Friday prayers. It's often accompanied by a burning of the American flag. In March 2015, Ali Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader and a leading Muslim cleric, shouted, "Death to America," during a speech to a frenzied crowd in Iran. He said this while President Obama was citing Khamenei himself as a source for why we should trust Iran on a nuclear deal. We are negotiating with these people? We are making it possible for them to obtain nuclear capabilities? Are we insane? Iran does not want to be our friend. They do not want peaceful coexistence. They want us, the great Satan, gone. To say otherwise is a very dangerous lie. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, understands this. Netanyahu has told Americans that a nuclear Iran is a far greater threat than ISIS. He has pleaded with Americans to listen to his warnings and has been virtually ignored by the Obama administration. The president even refused to meet with Netanyahu on a recent visit to Washington, D.C. The frosty relationship with the White House notwithstanding, Netanyahu found a welcome reception for his message in the halls of the U.S. Congress, where he was given the hero's welcome he deserved. Once Iran, the preeminent terrorist state of our time, acquires nuclear weapons, Netanyahu warned, it will be 100 times more dangerous, 1,000 times more dangerous, and more destructive. Netanyahu sees right through the bald-faced lies Iranian diplomats tell the West, and there are plenty of them. For example, referring to the Old Testament, Mohammad Javad Zarif, Iran's foreign minister, said, "If you read the book of Esther, you will see that it was the Iranian king who saved the Jews. Iran, you see, is an historic friend to the Jewish people and has absolutely no designs on destroying Israel." These are the kind of statements that get sent around in press releases and fact sheets by the Iranian Information Ministry, the U.S. State Department, and other regime lackeys. But dig a little deeper, and you'll see that Iran openly admits its intention to pursue nuclear weapons and destroy Israel. They tend to say these things in Farsi so that they don't get played on a loop in Western media, but consider the following quotes. Iranian President Mohammad Khatami, 2000. "If we abide by real legal laws, we should mobilize the whole Islamic world for a sharp confrontation with the Zionist regime. If we abide by the Quran, all of us should mobilize to kill." Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, 2001. "It is the mission of the Islamic Republic of Iran to erase Israel from the map of the region." Former commander of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps, Yahya Rahim Safavi, 2008. "With God's help, the time has come for the Zionist regime's death sentence." Khamenei's representative to the Mustazafan Foundation, Mohammad Hassan Rahimian, 2010. "We have manufactured missiles that allow us, when necessary, to replace Israel in its entirety with a big holocaust." Commander of the Basij Paramilitary Force, Mohammad Reza Naqdi, 2011. "We recommend them, the Zionists, to pack their furniture and return to their countries. And if they insist on staying, they should know that a time will arrive when they will not even have time to pack their suitcases." Ayatollah Khamenei, 2012. "The Zionist regime is a cancerous tumor, and it will be removed." Member of the Assembly of Experts Ahmad Alamulhoda, 2013. "The destruction of Israel is the idea of the Islamic Revolution in Iran and is one of the pillars of the Iranian Islamic regime. We cannot claim that we have no intention of going to war with Israel." Khamenei's representative in the Revolutionary Guard, Hojatul Islam Ali Shirazi, 2013. "The Zionist regime will soon be destroyed, and this generation will be witness to its destruction. Ayatollah Khomeini, 2014. This barbaric, wolf-like, and infanticidal regime of Israel, which spares no crime, has no cure but to be annihilated. Deputy Head of the Revolutionary Guard Hossein Salami, 2014. We will chase you, Israelis, house to house, and will take revenge for every drop of blood of our martyrs in Palestine. And this is the beginning point of Islamic nations awakening for your defeat. Hossein Salami, 2014. Today we are aware of how the Zionist regime is slowly being erased from the world, and indeed soon there will be no such thing as the Zionist regime on planet Earth. Secretary General of the Committee for Support for the Palestinian Intifada, Hossein Sheikholislam, 2014. The issue of Israel's destruction is important no matter the method. We will obviously implement the strategy of the Imam Khomeini and the leader Khamenei on the issue of destroying the Zionists. The region will not be quiet so long as Israel exists in it. Commander-in-Chief of the Revolutionary Guard Mohammad Ali Jafari, 2015. The Revolutionary Guards will fight to the end of the Zionist regime. We will not rest easy until this epitome of vice is totally deleted from the region's geopolitics. Threatening the annihilation of a nuclear-armed country is not something that a government that acts rationally or sees things through the lens of self-interest does. As discussed in Chapter 1, Iran's leadership is guided by a belief in the impending return of the 12th Imam, a return that coincides with the destruction of the world and the Day of Judgment. According to various hadith, the return of the Mahdi is preceded by total conflict that envelops the Middle East. Iranian regime officials have stated that the Mahdi cannot come under the current circumstances. Only war with and the eventual destruction of Israel can bring about the end times. As Muhammad said, according to one hadith, "The last hour would not come unless the Muslims will fight against the Jews and the Muslims would kill them until the Jews would hide themselves behind a stone or a tree and a stone or tree would say, 'Muslim or the servant of Allah, there is a Jew behind me. Come and kill him.'" In other words, annihilating Israel is the next step to ensuring the return of the Mahdi. Former Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's last speech at the United Nations in 2012 was filled with rhetoric about the Shia prophecy of the return of the 12th Imam. "God Almighty has promised us a man of kindness, a man who loves people and loves absolute justice, a man who is a perfect human being and is named Imam Al-Mahdi, a man who will come in the company of Jesus Christ, peace be upon him and the righteous," he said. The arrival of the ultimate Savior will mark a new beginning, a rebirth, and a resurrection. Remember, Ahmadinejad's insistence that the Mahdi is coming was not a closed-door speech at a mosque in Tehran. It was an address to the most prestigious international forum in the world. Other members of Iran's political religious establishment see their nation's destiny as linked to the Mahdi's emergence and see events in Iran's past and future as signs of his return. Reuters reported that Ruhollah Hosseinian, a politician and Islamic scholar, called the country's 1979 revolution the prelude to the appearance of the Mahdi. He also sees the alliance of Iranian forces with Hezbollah in Syria as the fulfillment of an 8th-century prophecy and another sign of the coming of His Holiness, because one Islamic prophecy speaks of armies with yellow flags like those that Hezbollah flies. Iran analyst Saeed Ghasemnijad, writing in the Times of Israel, reported a conversation between one of Iran's nuclear scientists, later killed by a car bomb, and Ayatollah Azizollah Khoshvat, a member of Supreme Leader Khomeini's inner circle. The scientist asked Ayatollah Khoshvat when the Mahdi would appear, and Khoshvat replied, "It depends on what you are doing in Natanz." Natanz, of course, is one of Iran's main nuclear facilities. According to Ghasemnijad, another cleric, Ayatollah Ali Saidi, the Supreme Leader's personal representative to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, reportedly claimed, "Ayatollah Khomeini is preparing Mahdi's reappearance and IRGC is the instrument to do it. Iran's top leaders see themselves as personal instruments for bringing about the Mahdi's return." These are the fervent beliefs of the men and women who sat across from U.S. diplomats in Geneva, negotiating over the legitimacy of the Iranian nuclear program. If Iran obtains a nuclear weapon, there is the distinct possibility, if not likelihood, it will use it to destroy Israel and threaten the United States. We know this because its leaders have said so over and over again.